coming to you from my apartment that doubles as a podcast recording studio. This is What Should I Do With My Life with Steph Horowitz. I'm Steph Horowitz. Thanks for joining me. This podcast is about how none of us know what we're doing. None of us have it figured out. No matter if you seem like you have it all together, you really don't, so be honest. We're going to talk about real stories from real people, their experiences, how they're figuring it out. From career pivots to being in the same industry for 40 years, we're going to hash this thing out so we can all find more meaning and passion in our work and day-to-days. Hi, everyone. What an episode we have today. I'm so excited for you to meet Richard Bachman, who's currently getting his PhD in history from the University of Michigan. Born and raised in East Germany, Richard's family ties to the past and social activism in the early 90s helped lay the groundwork in setting his passion for social engagement and education. Richard is a teacher, a student, a role model, a very unique person who's not afraid to deal with some discomfort in order to grow. In this episode, we talk about what sparked Richard's interest in Holocaust history and reconciliation work, what it means to carry a backpack of history in the present, and how finding your passion should be likened to growing in love instead of falling in love. What a pleasure and honor it was talking to Richard. An amazing, crazy conversation. It meant a lot to me. I hope you enjoy. Richard, very, very happy to have you joining me today on What Should I Do With My Life. Are you excited to be here?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, happy to be here, really. I'm super excited.
Let's do it. So, Richard, in one sentence, what do you do?
So I'm currently a PhD student at the History Department here at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor.
Go Blue.
Go Blue, I guess. I'm not like a huge sports person.
Go Blue, Richard. You just say it back.
Sorry. Okay. Go Blue. Yeah. And so I'm currently spending a lot of time in front of the computer on Zoom, both as a student, but also as a graduate student instructor working with undergraduate students. I have 73 this semester. I love teaching. You know, there's many reasons why people do grad school and why especially people do history. And oftentimes it's the research, right? They're interested in the past. They come to a tier one university like Michigan because it's an amazing research institution with an amazing library and archives and all kinds of, you know, access points to other great stuff. But to be honest, and my advisors probably don't like me saying that, but I'm here because I love the teaching. I'm really in grad school. I wanted to continue with my graduate education because I love teaching.
Yeah, I was wondering, I was going to ask that exact question about research. Is it the research that gets you going? Is it instructing? Do you want to be a professor? Just taking a step back. So growing up, did you want to be a teacher? Did you want to be a professor? Was there any big career aspiration you had?
I definitely didn't want to be a teacher or a professor. I didn't really think a lot about education, to be honest. I was really, really into Lego and building things. And so I thought, what I wanted to do is to be an architect, to be honest. I always build like little houses out of Lego. And then I had this other stuff, like little bricks. But I always really enjoyed the building part. And once it was done, it was kind of boring. You know, it was just like sitting there, okay, I'm just gonna, you know, pull it apart again. Education was just something that I did at the side that came naturally. I was not a hard-working student, but a good student, lazy, but always, you know, the B+ kind of student who never really studied that much, but which is good.
But then still did well.
I did well, yeah.
I hate people like you.
I know, you know, this is what...
I hate the lazy student who's naturally just smart and doesn't have to work hard and gets the B+. I have it out for people like you, whoever's listening. Ha ha.
You know, because I never pursued the architectural path. At one point, I don't know why, but maybe the politics came in and little music and things like that. I just moved away from that and got more interested in history.
Yeah. So where did it start? Because as I was preparing for this conversation, looking at, I know you're like, where to begin? When I was preparing for this talk and I was looking at everything you've done and your involvement and your passions and things like that, the two things that really stick out to me are education and service. And I'm wondering, are these strong values from your childhood? Did you grow up with these pillars?
I mean, first of all, your analysis is spot on, right? It is education and service, even though service to me always sounds a little bit like it is a business transaction. You know, you're kind of like, I see it more as social engagement on like different levels, right? It can be in a professional environment, but also, you know, just like having a good conversation with a friend and, or, you know, with one of your students, which is not necessarily about the course content, but life questions or things like that, right? And I don't know, I thought about this, like, where is this coming from? When did it start? And so on. I mean, my dad was for a long time a vocational teacher. So I've seen him and heard him talking about teaching, but he was not a trained teacher. He just came out of, you know, working for T-Mobile, telephone lines and that kind of stuff. And he's a very sociable guy. So at one point they asked him, would you want to take on our vocational students? And he was really good in it. And again, he never studied to be a teacher. So, but he still had an educational philosophy where it was all about seeing the whole student, like in their environment, where are they coming from and so on, and how does that influence their educational trajectory? And he also always spent time with them outside of the classroom in the sense that, hey, what's going on? Like, you're late all the time. What's the reason for that? And then, you know, to find out, yeah, you know, this student has like serious problems back home. So, you know, I suck this up more like indirectly than directly. I never did that with a purpose. I think, you know, sometimes you just do these kind of things and they're deeply ingrained in your head. My dad also has always been, and not just my dad, but also my grandma, for example, who's a very important person in my life, about not necessarily like helping other people, but being there for other people. Growing up in East Germany at a particular point in time, in a particular kind of environment, I grew up in the countryside, not in a big city. The countryside, there were a couple of small towns. And to be honest, it was a pretty rough time. East Germany in the 1990s, after German reunification, heavily deindustrialized, lost 90% of its industrial capacity. And because of that, there was, you know, a lot of social problems, unemployment, people moving away, things falling apart. And on the other hand, there were also, you know, alternative structures that developed, and politically speaking. And we had, I mean, I'm still so grateful and for that, but there were a bunch of kids that got together and they formed or created what was called an autonomous youth center. So a youth center that was run by kids for the kids. There was no social worker or anything like that. It was basically a building that the city gave to these kids. And like, okay, you know, that's your space. Like, do something with it. And these kids were anti-fascist activists. They were lefties. Mm-hmm. And that was very important. You know, having these kind of spaces in an area at a time where you also had a sizable neo-Nazi movement, and not just, you know, people marching. You know, there was a lot of violence, really physical violence in school, outside of that. So these spaces were really important. And at a point, I just stumbled into one of them because, you know, as it always happens, a friend asks you, hey, you know, my sister's dating this guy, he's playing in this band, do you want to check out this band? And you check out the band, and then you go to the next show. And so I became part of this DIY, do-it-yourself punk scene and anti-fascist scene. And I think I also observe what it means to do service. Like, a lot of kids, right, this is what they were doing. The center only existed because people organized shows, like organized that there was stuff for the bar, right? That people cooked when bands came to town. People organized reading groups. They ordered books and zines and things like that from the bigger cities and just things like that. And just by seeing that, and then at one point also becoming a part of that, I think that has been immensely important to me. And that's also something where I'm always, I don't know, very hesitant. You know this from the US, but here Antifa, you know, the anti-fascist movement is like a boogeyman. You know, they're like these violent left-wing activists who like to set things on fire and stuff like that. And they're just compared to, you know, white supremacist, right-wing, neo-Nazi groups, and they're made more or less the same. And sometimes in Germany, we have that same kind of conversation. But to me, it also means that people don't understand what this movement is actually about. Because in this small town environment, just talking about my upbringing, these autonomous youth centers, they were safe spaces. You know, there were safe spaces for people who were politically not online with or in line with, you know, the neo-Nazi bullies in school, but also for example, refugee kids that also lived in a couple of shelters in the area. And this was one of the very few places that they could go. Otherwise, you know, they were not safe. You have that part too. You have the educational part. Thanks to this movement, thanks to these people. Yeah, you know, there was violence. I don't want to deny that. It was oftentimes self-defense. Sometimes, you know, it was not. But then at the same time, there was also alternative educational infrastructure where you learned about racism, where you learned about anti-Semitism, where you learned about feminism and what it means to be socially engaged. Don't take everything that is being put in front of you, where you learn to play an instrument and be in a band or be an artist and do stuff and just be having sort of like a place and a group of people where all this energy, which is in you when you grow up, which sometimes, you know, gets self-destructive and so on, has some kind of place to go and some things to do. And yeah, I mean, as you can hear, you know, I'm immensely grateful for everyone who was a part of that and continues to be a part of it. And again, you know, there are problematic aspects for sure, but then there's also all this other stuff there. I mean, I don't know where I would be without that, to be honest. I would not be here. You know, I would not have done a lot of things in my life without that.
And I'm sure in the moment when you were involved in that group, you had no idea the effect and impact it would ultimately have on you and where you are. And I think that's such a good message for everyone. You know, these experiences really shape us and let them. You were talking about education and social engagement. And I just feel like through your work and really as a teacher, you can do both. You're able to do both. And you kind of, we're talking about that's something your dad kind of instilled within you that it's not just teaching, but the teaching is the way to socially engage and serve others and go above. You're obviously teaching is a gift, but you're checking in on them. You're building relationships with these people. It's based on your upbringing and where you were, it seems clear. Yeah, you were kind of in this activist-y circle. So do you think that because you were in this activist, you know, anti-fascism, this group of individuals who are passionate, proactive, looking forward. Do you feel like maybe that's what got you into history, the looking backward? Like, how did we get here? Or how do you think the love of history began? Because, you know, we'll talk about it. You're everywhere, Richard, in a very good way. There's like the American history, and then there's European and everything, and Jewish history. There's all the histories.
This is a really hard question. To be honest, I don't really know. I don't really know where that came from. I cannot really picture anything in my head, like a specific, you know, moment where all of a sudden this awareness and this kind of thinking kicked in. And for me, really, it is history is more a way of thinking than you know, engaging with a certain kind of subject. I think it is recognizing what came before, the kind of efforts that people made to contribute their tiny little piece to the present moment in which we find ourselves in. But then at the same time, also recognizing that this present moment and the way, for example, society is structured or our way of thinking and so on, It's just one version. It is not, it didn't have to be that way, right? There's no direct connection between what happened in the past and the present. In the past, there were many different possible futures and presents, and then one just kind of like succeeded or came to be the present we find ourselves in. And I think as my interest in history grew, that was also to me a really fascinating part, like the past alternatives, these past moments where certain possibilities were there, and then one path was chosen or was the one that just by accident was the one that people followed. But that also means there are many things which are open there. And I thinking about oneself and one's future and also society's future and things like that, that gives me a lot of hope. And I think, yeah, history is an area or however you want to call it, right, where you can find a lot of despair, like a lot of terrible things that happened. But then there's also a lot of hope and hopeful moments. Bringing these two together creates a certain kind of awareness of yourself in the world. A certain kind of there's to me for me at least there's certain humbleness that comes out of that because you realize, well, I'm just like a tiny little part in all of this. And I know that freaks a lot of people out because we are raised thinking of ourselves as the most important thing, right? Oh yeah, you know, I have to, and so on. Well, no, we're just like a tiny little fraction in a larger whole. But to me, I don't know, that doesn't sound like terrible.
It's perspective.
Just being aware that at the end of the day, yeah, what one does matters a lot. But it is also in correspondence to and in relation to so many other people and so many other factors and things like that. So one doesn't have to beat oneself up all the time about, well, here I fucked up, or you know, here I should have done this, and why, you know, am I not this person, or and so on. There are reasons for that, and there's a certain way of thinking about that, which I think comes out of studying history and seeing things in broader kind of contexts and environments.
If we were all historians and, we're looking at our lives through that kind of lens of that, I'm just kind of a speck in this larger context of what's going on, it probably would take a lot of pressure off of a lot of people. Not to say that one person can't make a difference, because we know they can, but at the same time, it works both ways. You said that there wasn't a specific moment that made you realize, oh, I want to study history. And I think that's super encouraging for people to hear, because some people are waiting for a magical aha snap moment to suddenly find this passion, and this is it, and this is what I want to do. And for you, it was interesting. You were learning, you went with it, you got into it. It was a gradual process. I think that's good for people to hear. It's comforting to me as well.
Again, talking to, I have these kind of conversations with students as well, right? And I think, you know, working in education and so on, yeah, we talk about the content a lot of these kind of courses. But I think at the end of the day, no matter what kind of course it is, even, you know, like a mathematics course or a chemistry course, you're always sort of you're tackling the purpose of it all, right? And so being prepared for these kind of conversation, having these, I love these conversations. What you were saying about this like aha moment or this like whoa epiphany or whatever, and then you kind of, I think we just trained to think like that because this is how they tell us these things happen, right? We hear these kind of stories like NPR and you know how I built this, and then they tell you, oh yeah, one day I just, you know, stumbled over something in the street, and then I built this company out of it. And yet, yes, there are like certain moments, but I think again, you know, thinking about this through the lens of someone who thinks about history and so on, that's also construction in which is done in hindsight. There were many different things that set you up in a certain kind of way, and if those many things, some of them you were not even fully aware of. But in a particular kind of moment, maybe they came together for some weird reason, and it maybe was the stone in the street and you stumbled over it and something clicked in your head or something like that, right? There is no singularity, like no, it's always part of a larger whole. And in a way, you know, this is like, now it gets a little, you know, beyond that, but it's almost like thinking about relationships and love, you know, and there's in the English language is this like falling in love, like you mm-hmm. head over heels and this kind of stuff. But you're also in a way set up, there's factors, and sometimes things also just take time to shape up. Mm-hmm. Right. And we might have these experiences in our lives where there's a person you meet and you're like, there's a spark. And then there's a person that has been around for some time and you have certain, you know, experiences with this person and things like that. And it slowly shapes up and you're like, well, wow, you know, mm-hmm. and then there's the stumbling moment at one point and you realize all these different kind of things. So, yeah, I mean, for connecting that back for the history moment, if I, you know, since you mentioned the Jewish history aspect, maybe like a specific aspect, yeah, I can pinpoint that to a specific moment. But the general interest in history, I cannot. And it was really hard for me writing, you know, these application materials for grad school where you ask this kind of question, right? And you have to fabricate a story about yourself. Again, you know, I don't want to say that these stories are false and wrong, but they also neglect a lot of other things which were subconsciously there, or you just push aside to tell a good story.
Yes, that was very well said. And okay, transitioning a little, even though not really. So we were talking about history, and then as you had mentioned that there was a specific moment, something that happened that got you into Jewish history. So just some context for the listeners, Richard, you, whoever's listening, you have a lot of experience when it comes to involvement in Jewish history, educating others, giving back to the Jewish community, Holocaust awareness. You were involved in the Action Reconciliation Service for Peace, the ARSP. You worked at the Holocaust Memorial Center in Michigan. There have been many other initiatives and projects you've done in between. So when did you realize that you wanted to get involved in these kind of activities? Tell us.
Again, you know, I think that there are many different factors really that contributed to that. And at one point just pushed me into action. And, you know, when we say Jewish history, I want to be precise. It's more the history of the Holocaust, right? That is the entry point. In a way, and there's mandatory Holocaust education in German public schools. There's no way you can get around this kind of topic. And also, I mean, the Holocaust is really foundational for what modern Germany is all about, right? It is reflected in constitutional values. It is there in the form of memorial sites, right, which used to be sites of mass killings. And there's really no way to avoid this kind of topic, but it is also in a lot of our families. It is, you know, and I'm now talking about non-Jewish families. My family is non-Jewish. And I remember this was really early. I think I always say I was 9 years or 10 years maybe or something like that. And my parents watched this documentary on German TV, and it was a whole kind of series of documentaries at the time about the Holocaust. I was watching that, and I remember, you know, and there was a graphic scene of a young soldier engaging in an act of violence against, you know, Jewish civilians in the Ukraine. But I remember going to bed after seeing that, and being just so angry. Like I couldn't fall asleep really. And I also couldn't fall asleep because I knew at this point that my grandfather, right, was such a young soldier. He served in the German army during World War II. So in my head, I made that connection. Like, and I knew that the soldier that I'd seen in the documentary was not my grandfather, but it could have been my grandfather, right? And my family, and a little different than a lot of families in Germany, has always been very open about talking this part of our past. My grandfather passed away when I was too young to be able to talk to him directly about that, but I talked a lot with my grandma about that. So, I think that in a way made this large kind of topic a very personal kind of topic and really sparked my interest. And then in school, right, we talked about this multiple times. We did these trips to former concentration camps, which are now memorial sites, to see and to engage with that. But interestingly enough, and that is only something that dawned upon me later on, we always talked about this in a very abstract kind of way and black and white. And we never really, the Jewish perspective was a perspective of the past, even as if there were no Jews around anymore, and I was not aware in my small town, rural environment that there were Jewish families. So no one ever said, "Hey, I'm Jewish." Maybe there were people in my school who were Jewish. I don't know. So it was always sort of like in the distance. It happened in these like big concentration camps, and it happened in the past, black and white, and so on. And yeah, here are survivors, and we never had a survivor come to our school talk, but we watched a video of a survivor talking about this, right? So you are aware that there are also people in the present who have this connection, but they were old. They were not like people our age. So in a way, Jewish life was really confined to the past in a weird kind of way, and it was really only confined to the Holocaust. And only really later on, I realized that, wait, there's Jewish culture. It sounds so weird to say that now, but there's Jewish life in the present. And then there's, vivid communities and people my age with the same kind of problems, and the same kind of issues and so on, who happen to be Jewish. And it's just an e such a easy, realization, but it was sort of profound. The real moment of realizing that, which is all strange, came in the US, weirdly enough. The first time I traveled to the US was to visit my sister, Teresa, who was also involved in Action Reconciliation Service for Peace. So Action Reconciliation Service for Peace is an organization from Germany, based in Germany, and they came out of the Protestant Church. And they still have connections to the Protestant Church, but you don't have to be Protestant or religious in any kind of way to participate. And they came out of the Protestant Church or part of it that realized that they were, by not having done something in opposition to the Nazis, they also, in a way, became involved in what happened, right? They were not innocent only because they were not in the German army or anything like that, or never killed someone directly. But they set up this organization to engage with this past, and also Action Reconciliation Service for Peace is actually, the German name is Sign for Atonement Service for Peace. So there's a different kind of connotation, which I might like a little bit better, atonement than reconciliation. Because in a way, reconciliation implies that, you pay back the debt, and then, it's done and we can move forward. And I think this is a part of the past which cannot, you there's no way that you can ever make this go away. And also that shouldn't be the case, because then you forget, and that's highly problematic, right? So the organization mission was to go into countries and communities that were harmed by Nazi Germany and the Holocaust, and sort of offering assistance to rebuild, assistance to support, and to work with these communities, really. And I really liked that offering aspect of it. Not like we marching in, right? And here we are, the good Samaritans, and we rebuild, and the very German kind of way of thinking, most of the time, right? It was humble and listening first and learning first. And because what can you really expect? You cannot really go somewhere, you cannot go to Israel, for example, and just expect that people are like, "Oh my God, you're so great because you came here," and so on. No, I totally understand if there was and it still is a lot of resentment, and for very good reasons. Even if people my generation or younger generation and so on, yeah, we were not directly involved, right? But we are still part of this larger history there. So anyway, the organization started working with countries and communities in Europe. And then they also expanded, and they are now in Israel and in the United States. And there they're mainly working with Jewish organizations and in Jewish communities, but they're also doing a lot of social justice work. And my sister was the first in the family to do a 1 year voluntary service. They have these 1 year voluntary service programs for young Germans, a lot of them just graduating out of high school. And my sister worked in Pittsburgh. She worked there in the Jewish community. And, since she was in the US, I'm like, well, that gives me an opportunity to come and visit. And so I did at one point. And I remember I took the Greyhound bus on a Friday to come to Pittsburgh. And the bus dropped me off in downtown Pittsburgh. But my sister was working in Squirrel Hill, which is the Jewish neighborhood. But I saw like people walking to the synagogue. That was one of these moments, one of these weird click moments where I'm like, whoa, there's Jewish life happening in the. I was, for whatever reason, I was just like so struck by seeing families walking to a synagogue and seeing the menorah, lit in windows and things like that. And I came back from that trip, and I just wanted to learn more. I wanted to engage more with that kind of history. And I could have done that in Germany, right? Why did I need to go to the US in order to have this kind of experience, right? You can see it in Leipzig, where I spent a lot of time of my life. You can see it in Berlin and places like that. But for whatever reason, I had to be in Pittsburgh.
It's interesting how you had that moment when you were 9 years old, and then I imagine it stayed with you, and then later in life, things kind of fell into place, and you could kind of act on this. You said that your sister was also involved in the ARSP. So is this something that was common, something felt, this kind of, I don't know if it's responsibility, did you, because for me, well, it's very interesting for me to hear this, as the granddaughter of Holocaust survivors, like it's the most amazing thing ever to hear what you do and what you did and what you continue to do. It means a lot. And I guess it's so complicated. Like, I'm just wondering if you and your family or friends, if you felt like you were carrying this really heavy thing that wasn't necessarily yours to carry, if you felt accountable somehow. Of course, this is way before you were around, but it's something, it's part of the history. And now we're in the moment now, which will be history. And I don't know. It's tough. It's tough. How, what was that like for you? Did you feel that?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, right, there's always this discussion in Germany and beyond about, guilt. Like, are people motivated by guilt to do these kind of things? Is that really their motivational force? For myself, I don't think so, because, I'm not driven by guilt. Maybe if I would talk to a psychologist, they would maybe say something else. But the way I see it, it's more a sense of responsibility. It is, yeah, you want to know what, I mean, I'm still, we have done some research on my grandfather, and I said he was in the German army. He was actually in the SS, and he was in the army part of the SS, so not the part that was guarding the concentration camps, but he was still in this organization, right? And he was there at the end of the war, so 1945, as an 18-year-old, he was drafted, right? It's the last kind of, or he was not drafted, he volunteered. to go there, right? Which is also something where, like, well, this is not like he was forced to do these kind of things and he had no choice, and these strong narratives, right? But he made a decision to do that. And then there's all these stories that my grandma told me, right? He gets sick, he loses his friend in the very first battle that they have, right? And he's just fed up with this whole thing and wants to disappear and so on. But he's still there, and he's in Prague at the end of the war. There was a rebellion in Prague, which was really brutally put down by the German forces in the city at the time. Well, of course you ask yourself, so where was he? Like, what was he doing? Was he involved in any kind of way? And we have done research on it, didn't find anything really on that part. And then after the war, he caught by the Soviets and he disappeared for 5 years in a gulag. He was there as an 18-year-old and for 5 years, and then he came back and sort of a broken man, health broken, the spirit broken, became an alcoholic, right? This whole kind of, so there's all this like really complicated personal history, which is part of that larger kind of history. And I think that over the years, that really, and also in conversation with my grandma, that really kept me going in a sense. And I'm like, well, and the responsibility part is, yes, there's this personal connection, but I think also what was really, for me, a motivational force, a driving force, was what I experienced growing up. These neo-Nazi movements, like the swastika graffiti that would appear all the time on this wall. We called it the battle war wall because, it was like a swastika graffiti. The next day, the anti-fascists came and they crossed it out and they wrote Antifa over it. And the next day, the neo-Nazis came at night and they crossed out the anti. So it would just say fascist. And this kind of thing. But just seeing that and connecting that to the past, and like, how can these people still be around? How can they still be fascists? Can they still be Nazis? And I think that really, in a way, created that sense of responsibility. Like, yeah, I can change the past. I can't undo what my grandpa did, and so many other grandpas did, and grandmas as well, right? But I can actually do something about this present. This is where I can become active. And if it's in the educational sector, telling people or helping people to see this kind of history and making connections, then it's that. This is where really my motivation came for, to be more involved in Action Reconciliation Service for Peace. Telling also people like you, right, who have the same kind of family history connection to this topic, but on the other side, in a sense. Also, talking about our different perspectives on that, and not to make them like equal and say, well, you have a, this kind of stuff. No, but just seeing the larger kind of whole on a very personal kind of level. And I think this is also what I really liked and continue to like about Action Reconciliation Service for Peace and the kind of work they're doing with Jewish communities, but also then with this exchange program I became more involved in after that, which is Germany Close Up, where Jewish groups from North America come to Germany for a week or a little bit longer than that to engage with that kind of history, but also to meet people their age who are non-Jews, who are, German, who oftentimes have this family, direct family connection to this piece of past, right? And have these conversations, like meeting each other eye to eye and realizing that this kind of past is very present for a lot of Jewish and non-Jewish families today.
On a personal level, I'm very glad to know that it's not guilt. It's this feeling of responsibility and taking things forward because it's so tricky. I imagine that some of your peers or other friends feel like they're carrying a guilt that's not theirs. Like you didn't do anything. you shouldn't, can't feel guilty. But of course, as empathetic human beings, and you're part of, you know, part of a history or a land or a people or whatever, whether it's family members or farther down the lineage, we all sometimes often will feel some kind of responsibility. So I imagine it's difficult to wrestle with. And I'm just really glad, and I hope that, you know, other people like you don't feel guilty for something that they shouldn't feel guilty for. And on the other hand, it makes me really happy to see what you're doing. And it means a lot to me on a personal level. And I'm sure it means a lot to a lot of people. Something that is weaving in and out of the conversation this whole time that I just love is when we were talking about history, and you're talking about history, and on the one hand, we're a speck, but on the other hand, it just shows how much one person can do, and so important. And, you know, again, you can fight it. You can argue it this way. You can argue it that way, but just this conversation just shows what one person can do. But also, because we're a speck in the history, you don't need to freak out if you miss a deadline or if you fail this test, everything's going to be fine. It's interesting that some of the work you were doing, I imagine, may not have always been well received. If you had good intention, I'm just picturing, for example, this outreach work you're doing, this social engagement work, perhaps it's, I don't know, lecturing to Jewish students or visiting with Holocaust survivors. I'm sure there've been some experiences that weren't the most pleasant, where obviously you had the best of intentions and you came, like you said, I come first to listen. And that's an amazing attitude and important. I'm sure it was really challenging emotionally and just in every sense of the word, some of the work you did, some of the encounters you had. How did you prepare, or how did you deal with that?
That's also a good question. And you are absolutely right. I mean, there were moments where, yeah, you know, you have good intentions, but I always tried to understand that. I understand that reaction, right? I wouldn't say, hey, here I am. I'm a very different person. Like, why are you yelling at me? Or why, you know, I can see in your body language and so on that I make you uncomfortable and I trigger something, you know, my German accent in English, for example, or something like that, right? And take this as like a personal offense. No, I mean, I understand. I was spending time in Detroit working at the Holocaust Museum there. I was amazed how few of these kind of instances happened. Overwhelmingly, there were like two or three times where someone reacted in this kind of way to my presence or to me engaging with that person. Overwhelmingly, people were welcoming, warm, grateful, sometimes even to a point where it made me feel uncomfortable because I'm like, you know, wait, this is very complicated. And this is, you know, they're like, oh yeah, he's whatever, the representative of a whole new generation. And
it's a lot of pressure.
Yeah, you become the spokesperson for a country and, you know, for a generation. I'm like, you know, I mean, no, I'm not an exception. I'm not unique, but you know, there's also a lot of people who see things very different than I do and people who do this kind of work of my generation. To be honest, I didn't really prepare for the quote unquote negative encounters, right? I felt like that this might happen, but it was not like, okay, if it happens, I know I need to step back or, you know, like right. Know certain things to say and so on. And again, the only way maybe I prepare for that is that I saw a response like that as justified and I wouldn't judge it in any kind of way. And one time, which was, I think might have been my first or second day at the museum. And I thought, oh boy, you know, it was like a public event and we were handing out things and I handed something to a gentleman who was second generation. And, you know, I handed and I explained, and he noticed, he picked up on the German accent, like, immediately. He's like, I don't want this from you. You know, why are you here? And he got really upset. And then his mom came, you know, this elderly lady, and she got mad at him. She's like, why are you yelling at this person? You know, you don't know him. And, you know, there's kind of like, and I was like trapped in the middle. I didn't really know how to respond, but just like, kind of like, I'm sorry. And you know, she lectured him like that. This was
good.
Not an accurate kind of response and so on. It's like, you know, don't mind him. And it's going to be okay. We have this and that history in our family, and try to explain a little bit where this strong reaction came from.
To me, it feels very brave in putting yourself in a position that's likely going to be uncomfortable at certain points. And like you said, people might write you off right away, which is really hard and it's not fair. And you being able to be understanding, and, you know, it takes a special kind of person. And it's this kind of vulnerability, especially, I don't even know, that I feel like we're getting into some seriously deep shit right now. I don't know what, like, I for just a I quick check that. In. You know, are you doing just really a quick check in? Like, are you doing okay?
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
Okay, no, good.
I absolutely love that kind of stuff.
Okay, so good. It's like who you are, Richard. It doesn't matter if you're a veterinarian. It doesn't matter if you're a scuba diver. It doesn't matter if you're a pilot. It doesn't matter if you're a teacher. Just, it could be triggering for you to say hello to someone. Just you as you are could be triggering to someone. And that's insane. That's such an insane, crazy. That's just so crazy.
Yeah, you have this backpack of this history, and you're carrying it, and you have to relate to it in a certain kind of way, even if you don't want to. Again, I think it's an awareness issue at the end of the day. And yeah, it's not always comfortable. But do we always want comfort? You know what I mean? That doesn't really, I don't know, you know, again, I'm thinking about personal growth and societal growth and so on, and comfort. This is not how growth happens, you know, like, not at all. There has to be conflict. There has to be, you know, two heads or many heads clashing from time to time, disagreement.
We need to feel uncomfortable, and it's super important. And even just in this podcast, it's something that I'm going through, and in a way that's somewhat public, you know, like, I don't have these conversations every day, like the conversation I'm having with you, and also kind of putting it out there. It's uncomfortable on many different levels, but it's important and I need to grow. And if I don't ask the questions and learn, and you teach me and we learn from each other, you know, what's going to happen? We're not going to move. So how did you end up in Michigan? Now you're in Ann Arbor, you're getting your PhD. You worked at the Holocaust Memorial Center. You were involved in all these different Detroit projects and Repair the World. And how'd you get there?
Yeah, my entryway to, or gateway to Detroit or Michigan or whatever, really was working at the Holocaust Memorial Center. And yeah, I came to Detroit to do that. But since I was already there, I also had the opportunity really to explore Detroit. And I mean, what a city that is. What an amazing place with amazing people. And really amazing history. I think, you know, that might be something that a lot of people are not really aware of, but just the richness of Detroit's history on so many levels. We're talking social movements, we're talking music and culture, right? Also a lot of ugly history there as well. And you know, industrial history and all kinds of things. So many things to explore, but I also just met amazing people. One word that comes to mind is a certain sense of creative resilience that people show, right? The odds are stacked high against them. Like, these are not beautiful places, right? These are oftentimes cities and regions that are sort of falling apart, right? They had their old glory, industrial glory and so on. Then, you know, companies moved, jobs moved with the companies, and things were like slightly falling apart. But yet people still hold out, and they are really creative in finding ways to respond and do a hell lot of things with very little material resources oftentimes. And I think in a way, you know, that just reminded me of back home. That reminded me of the do-it-yourself punk scene, being creative. So, you know, after I was done with my service at the Holocaust Center, I'm like, I can't let go of this place. You know, I can't go back. And oh, this was like a 1 year kind of thing and so on. So as you mentioned, I became involved in a couple of these programs, which also allowed me to come back to Detroit a year later and a year after that and a year after that. And then, you know, as I was already here, I also talked to people at the University of Michigan. And you know, it was in the back of my mind. I wasn't really sure at the time when I was done with my voluntary service here in Detroit, working at the museum, that I wanted to do grad school in the US and a PhD and all of that. But then at one point, I'm like, yeah, I want to do that. And why not doing that in the US? I'm still amazed almost on a daily basis that they actually got me into the program and accepted me. But yeah, here I am.
Do you see yourself settling in America? Big question. I get this question a lot too, and I hate it. So if you hate me right now, I understand.
Yeah, you know, of course, I also get this question, and I don't, to be honest, I don't know. But it also doesn't freak me out that I don't know the answer. If I had a chance in picking where I would move next, it would depend on people. It would depend on, you know, is the place in itself an interesting place? There is something to be explored with almost every place.
But I think it's great that it's not just about the job. I mean, you have your life and the things that motivate you and push you and interest you and intrigue you that aren't just the work. It's what you said, life and living and surroundings. And we need to remember that's why we're here. We're not just here to work all day. We're here to explore, like you said.
Yeah, I would say that I would always put life first and then the work follows. We understand that we need to make money in order to survive in this society, which depends on money and us making money to survive. But it can also very quickly become a justification for pushing life aside and just making life always the second priority. I'm not a spiritual person and I'm not religious. So for me, there's only one life, right? I know that if my life ends, everything ends for me. And yes, your work in a certain kind of sense, right? You can find purpose in that and so on. But just make that the sole focus of where you're looking for meaning and purpose, I think is the wrong strategy. You know, it's the wrong way to do. Because yeah, what happens if you can't work? Either because you're getting too old or you're sick or you don't find a job or something like that. You know, what is left? And also, like spending all of your life just working, I don't know. You know, I would rather sit for hours together with friends, enjoy good food and drink, have a conversation, take a walk. You know, these kind of things. I think this is what creates purpose and meaning in life.
Would you say that's your, would you say in a nutshell, your advice for someone who doesn't know what to do with his or her life, life first and work second?
I think what I've been there. You know, I think there's very few people who never get to this point where they're like, what is this all about? Like, what am I doing? Am I doing the right thing? Does this make any kind of sense? And so on. And I know a lot of people are really scared by these moments and these kind of questions. But then at the same time, they're also good questions. The Black Pumas, do you know this band?
No.
Their band, right? The Black Pumas. And they have a song called Confines, which is a beautiful song. And the line is, in life's confines, I try to let my soul refine. So you're kind of like aware that, yeah, you know, there are these confines, there are these things that just prevent me from being everything, everybody, you know, achieving everything and so on. But you're still refining your soul within these confines, right? You're still able to become active, to grow, to seek out possibilities and develop and things like that, right? I'm excited to be here, to be where I am right now. I always say, and that's a piece of wisdom maybe that, comes from my grandma, but she's always like, yeah, and she was someone who had a really hard life, really physically, emotionally, an extremely hard life. But then at the same time, you could just tell that she was, in her 90s. But at the same time, she was just so grateful for still being around, still being able to sit down with me for 2, 3 hours, have coffee and cake and talk about things and see what I was doing and, how my life shapes up and so on. To look at these moments of your life and be grateful that they are there. So far, it's been great, So this is why on my bucket list is just more of that.
Where can people follow you, stay up to date with you, learn more about you, your work?
I have a faculty profile at the University of Michigan that people can check out.
Yes.
I guess a LinkedIn. There's a really nice, maybe to end this, right? A really nice quote from a German writer, Dietmar Dart is his name, and he's like, people are made out of people. So when people are constantly freaking out about, oh my God, if I'm gone, no one will remember me, or what is my impact that I make, and so on. In a way, you've already done that. You're already in a lot of other people.
Richard, this was amazing.
Thank you so much for having me.
Hi, everyone. I told you it'd be a wild episode. Very meaningful, very special, intense, all the things. A few insights. Throughout the conversation, we talked about our role in history. On the one hand, how one person can make such an impact. On the other hand, how small of a speck we are in the context of the world. It can really help us put things in proportion, but also show us the power we have as an individual. So whichever way best fits your narrative, go for it. I love how we talked about what it means to be vulnerable in your work and putting yourself out there. You might go into something with great intentions and it might not always be well received. Richard put himself on the line every day just by engaging with people in his work, just by being who he was. As he said, discomfort is what helped him grow and what can help us all grow. Lastly, the importance of putting life first and putting work second. It's so easy for us to put work on the forefront, put life to the side, and miss out on experiences and opportunities. Let's be more mindful and always put life first. That's it. Thank you.